I've lived a thousand lives. I've piloted a thousand souls. I've healed and fought and died just for another role.
This is the Happy Jacks RPG Podcast, a roundtable discussion that's a mix of friendship, humor, unbridled enthusiasm, and tabletop RPG topics sent in from around the world.
Just for another.
Welcome to Season 33, Episode 18 of Happy Jacks RPG Podcast. My name is Jason.
My name is Alex.
I'm Pooja.
In this week's episode, we have a topic to discuss. Mike asks how to make weapons feel unique and varied. We have emails. Steffi wants our takes on open table secrets that cause problems. And Eric from New Jersey has a con report. If you'd like to contribute a question or story to the show, email us at happyjacksrpg@gmail.com. That's happyjacksrpg@gmail.com. I think there's also now a channel to do that in our Discord. You could check out that and our next game days, which is set for May 18th at happyjacks.org/discord. And a GameX at the Hilton LAX, which is the next piece of Strategicon. There are three Strategicons every year, and the one in May is called GameX. May 24th to 27th, and we will be doing our live show that Saturday night, as we always do. It's a lot of fun. Come out, join us live, or hop on the stream. It is usually slightly inebriated and very fun. Our indie designer of the month is Nerdburger Games, the game design imprint of Craig Campbell, him. Nerdburger Games endeavors to create games that explore corners of the RPG landscape that haven't been explored or haven't been explored very often. These games forego dense gaming mechanics in favor of lighter rule sets that allow players to focus on telling fun, engaging, memorable stories. This week's game is Low Stakes. In Low Stakes, you portray a gothic horror monster, like a vampire, werewolf, or ghost, or one of their human friends sharing a home with other monsters in the modern day. As it turns out, you're not very good at it. In this GM-less RPG, you'll engage in sitcom-style shenanigans as you and your friends guide your characters through the vicissitudes of conventional 21st century life, all the while trying to master your character's problem areas and vie for influence among your monstrous roommates. It sounds like it'd be a good, like, vibe as a pretend reality show.
Yeah.
What we do in the shadows, kind of.
Oh, yes, awesome.
Exactly.
And it's $9.99 on DriveThruRPG. So Nerdburger Games, DriveThruRPG, $10. That's awesome. Okay. Well, let's see. So our discussion topic today was sent in by Mike. Mike says, my group recently has been playing Pathfinder 2nd Edition. I am quite happy with the way the weapons make themselves unique by letting you perform certain actions that are usually more restricted. What rules have you used or would like to use to make weapons feel more unique and varied in your games?
That's a great question. My favorite kind of unique fun weapon is, of course, a weapon with a personality. I mean, I always love a sentient weapon, especially a sentient weapon with secrets. I think it's a great way to incorporate history in your game as well, or a character that has a very different knowledge set than the players, maybe, especially if they're more of like a roleplay heavy group, bringing in an old cursed like grandpa who was a major warrior in a battle 200 years ago, and you get to like pull that history stuff in. I love that. Or like a goofy longbow for your super, super serious ranger. Love it.
Janine Garofalo's father's head, the bowling ball. Makes me happy.
Yeah.
I enjoy like how, and this is super basic.
Yeah.
But I don't care. Basic and proud. That really leaning into the ways different weapon types, like oftentimes we group weapons together by types because like you need to in terms of the game or whatever. But if you look at drilling down into the individual weapons that your characters chose, they'll have their own idiosyncrasies.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I did in Castoffs actually is the weapons I chose for Lucky were katars, which are stabbing daggers.
Yeah.
You can block with them. You can slice with them kind of, but they are made to punch people with a blade that they're in the hand. And then the sword that they ended up getting throughout the course of the gameplay was a flexible, like, whip-like sword.
Yeah.
That was fun.
And that's actually based on a historical weapon.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a historical weapon.
Yeah.
You could look up videos of people using it online. It's kind of amazing, but it's, but each of them have their own like unique attributes that I could play into as a character to make it a little different than just like, oh, I swing my longsword at you.
Yeah.
And it may have the same stats and like mechanical effects, but it gives you room to play in the narrative.
Yeah. This is always an interesting spot for me to land because my instinct is to shy away from things that make combat more detailed, which doesn't mean I think it's a bad thing to do, but my instinct, so in my mind, there's this scale in game design of anywhere from like simulationist on one end to fucking, you know, Looney Tunes
yeah.
on the other end, right? And like where your game is having fun is different for you and your group and your players. I am really unlikely to design at the simulationist end because I'm less interested in, okay, well, this sword is good for poking, but not slashing. And I'm like, well, but okay, do 4 damage and let's move on. Like, to me, that's not the most exciting part of the story. But of course, if it could trip someone or if it can restrain them or, you know, like, okay, something like that starts to get interesting. But even that, I would rather just have a move. Like, I'd rather have an action or have, I don't know. I think about this kind of stuff a lot because I think a lot of people enjoy this. Like, Pathfinder yeah. is very popular and has a bunch of stuff like this.
This is something I absolutely love.
Oh, good. Okay.
Like, kind of other end of the spectrum where I love to get, like, nitty and gritty and do crazy complicated combos in combat, although I haven't designed as much as of that, I would say. And I think as a designer, I'd find it more difficult to, like, track.
Yeah, well, and I love that shit in video games.
Yeah.
I love it. So,
but, yeah, like Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah.
I love finding all the crazy weird weapons and combos you could do.
Yep.
And I think that's a, rather than, this is the difference, right? Between like a rule set that gives you specifics for each kind of weapon and what you as a table decide, like either flavor-wise or if it allows you to have access to a move.
Yeah.
That maybe your character wouldn't have access to, or like in the case of flexible whip sword, suddenly you've got reach beyond what you would normally have because this specific weapon is actually 10 feet long as opposed to 5 feet long or yeah. whatever it is.
I also really, in terms of advice or an idea to make weapons feel more unique and varied, I've been thinking about combining a mechanical benefit with a social benefit recently because I've been working on mm-hmm. Daggerheart for Darrington. And thinking about how...
Now, what's the... Sorry.
I'm not going to do the whole pitch my game thing, but we have some domain cards. These are like ability cards. And thinking about the option of taking one, if it just like makes your armor class better, and then another thing makes you better at speaking to someone, it's an obvious choice what you're going to pick if you prefer one thing over the other. You know, mechanically, it might be like, this is obviously the best thing to do for a build. But I actually really like doing this thing for roleplay, and that's kind of difficult. I love the idea of a weapon that also gives like a completely weird benefit. Like you pick up these close daggers, right? And then it means whenever you whisper to someone one-on-one, you can't be overheard. Like something really
oh, yeah.
weird and out there that relates to the weapon's like culture or history or how it was built or designed. Maybe not even necessarily magic. Just like when you carry this shield on your back, you feel more guarded. So you would have disadvantage on like sharing a secret or determining if someone is lying or something like that.
Insight or something like that.
Yeah, just like
okay.
a weird roleplay benefit. That's because I would love to pick up a weapon that does something like that.
Okay, I'm fired up now. That is something I had not thought about and is real interesting to me. All that like non-combat stuff, because I was listening to this sort of controversial thing Brennan Mulligan was talking about, but like he likes telling heavy story, big feelings games in D&D because it does combat really well. That's the part he doesn't want to have to think about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel similarly, right? Of like, I don't want to have to think about combat, which is why I'm not going to play D&D. But like, I get where he's coming from, right? Like, that, I understand his mindset there. But the idea that we're talking about what items, magic items or weapons or armor could do outside of combat is exciting to me because combat is complicated enough almost always in every system. And making it more complicated, usually doesn't meet my critical mass of making it better.
Yeah.
Like it has to make it enough better that the added complication is worth it in my mind. So, but if it's this sort of static benefit outside of combat or something like that, like that's really exciting to me. I haven't really thought about that before.
Yeah. Thinking about like the moves in Thirsty Sword Lesbians mm-hmm. related to like, you know, are you parrying? What are you doing? And that is kind of separate from the weapon you're wielding. Mm-hmm. Usually, I think you could have a really good time with a system for weapons where the combat itself is not the complicated element at all.
Yeah.
Like you can't parry, you can't riposte, you don't have any battle moves. You don't even really attack the same way unless you pick up that weapon. So like you just pick the mechanic or rule you're interested in. Like if you take whip, then the way you would operate in combat cares about how far away people are from you and no one else cares.
Right.
Right. Or like if you take a dagger, you only care about if you're behind someone. And it's like you're always trying to attack from behind. I think if you take rule sets that would be way too complicated for everyone to know, and you say you only have to know the specific way that your weapon works, that can really help with the learning curve and comprehension. And it also, I feel like, puts the impetus on the players a little bit more if the GM doesn't have to know all the rulings of like flanking and distance and grappling and all of that. It's just the player who has the whip tells the storyteller, okay, I need your character to do this for me when I attack.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking like you were describing that, and I'm like, but does then it make it more complicated for the GM if like there's this million different rules? But
and even then, like even if you're not reliant on the players at the table to tell you like, okay, this is what I need, learning just the rule set for the weapons that your players are using and knowing those,
yeah,
and then you just shift it out, and it's a much more like graduated way to learn those different rules that could be super complicated rather than having like, here is your calculus tome.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Of how combat will work. You get it in these like little bite-sized pieces. Because if you're only learning, say, four weapons, or like maybe somebody doesn't, like you have a spellcaster who is not using a weapon. You have three weapons that you deal with regularly and one that you deal with rarely. And you're just like, that's a very easy to me thing to manage.
Yeah.
Versus having to know the kind of all the permutations of what something could turn into.
Yeah.
That's a really great idea.
I've been thinking about that recently because I did a playtest of a game by Jay Dragon called Seven Part Pact that's on Jay's Patreon. And it kind of changed my brain chemistry a little bit. It might be one of the best tabletop games I've ever played. And each character, you play one of seven wizards. Each wizard has their own playbook. It's basically their own game. Like one wizard is doing war and is controlling all of the relationships between the country and other countries. One necromancer has this whole map of the gates of hell and they're like fighting enemies. And they are only really care about their own domains and how the rules work in those domains until at the end of the month, you come together and you're like, well, you killing this guy in the war caused complication for me and death. And why are you messing with that? Or like my library got messed up because the mariner sent a storm over to my isle. And like the way that the rules interact generates interest, but each player becomes more responsible just for being really good at their thing. And in that game, like if I was playing the librarian wizard, I wouldn't even have access to a map of the world. Like I wouldn't even know what the world looked like, so I don't have to care about it. That's the mariner's job.
Interesting. Okay.
And so I've been thinking about that idea of like, if you just said the only person who needs to care about finesse combat is the rogue and it's their domain and they know all the rules for it, it takes weight off of the GM to really know how that works. It makes them feel good. Like this is their thing that they're in charge of and they're spectacular at. And it, I think, causes specialization to feel less spotlighty. Mm. Like if everyone is specializing in something, it can be helpful to balance the table because if like you have a weapon build that's always ideal or always does a ton of damage and the one player takes that and it's like they're always the best in combat, it can take away from the balance of like a combat narrative. But I don't know. I'm just thinking about that like specialization idea of I'm really good at this. I'm really good at this. And I only need to know that. So if you want to come over here and learn how to grapple people. You ask me, not the GM.
Sure. The thing I started thinking about there, though, is, for instance, introducing a new player to the game.
Yeah.
And on one hand, there's a piece of that that sounds like, okay, well, they only have to learn their character sheet, which you see a lot in PBTA, like in Masks. I sat down the very first time and played the one that would let me be a robot boy.
Oh, yeah.
Shocking to everyone.
That's never.
But Adam was running it and was very quick to explain that, like, I don't have to worry about what all the other playbooks can do. Look at what this one does. This has all the descriptions. And then from here, say what you want to do and we'll do it. Right. Yeah. Like that was a really great way to get into that. And then I was so excited. I did read all the other playbooks, but I'm also not a brand new player at that point either. It just, it makes me think though, if I'm a new player and I'm trying to decide what class I want to play.
Yeah, it really.
Now I have to read, or like that wizard game, I'm imagining a new player, a person new to TTRPGs, not new to that game, which it's not everything has to be designed for that. But it's...
I think it makes it easier because what this also does, like what this specialization also does is give you that pitch line for what the character is good at right off the top. In the game that you were just referencing, like the librarian is about taking care of this library and has X goal.
Yeah.
The necromancer is about taking care of the gates. So like you can say, even just knowing nothing else about that, what kind of archetype you would want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Which, when you're talking about introducing someone new to RPGs to any kind of class, actually requires less like in-depth preparation, in my opinion, than trying to create a character in a system that where you need to know general rules.
Yeah. I think it makes me want weapons to have a byline now. It's like, why am I going to read this whole table of all these weapons that do specialization things? When you tell me I pick up the flame blade sword and that makes me a fire caster, like that is my specialization. I get it in the name of the weapon. That I like that idea more than having to like know all of the choices and just having things be specific enough that you get the vibe.
Yeah.
Straight off.
Yeah. I think another thing that you're kind of touching on as well, or at least the topic has touched on, is the idea of an item that's a must pick or a never pick.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like in D&D, for instance, because a lot of us can reference that, there is, to the best of my knowledge, no reason to pick a dagger because a short sword can do whatever a dagger does and it's a die type up, right? So like, aside from being a good throwing weapon, I think short sword's not a good throwing weapon or something.
Yeah, dagger
right?
is thrown. And...
Right. So, okay, but like crossbows are better than daggers and... Like, suddenly the dagger is a never pick. Like, I don't know anybody who picks them on purpose except to be able to say, I'm covered in knives. Which, okay, that's fun. Like, that's a good reason to take it as well. But when do people use them in combat when they don't need to, right? It's that kind of stuff. Or weapons where it's fun to have a fun description on it, but if it boils down to, this is a D10 with reach, and this is a D10 with reach, and this is a D10 with reach, why do we have the extra text? If it's not like a flame blade or, you know, if it's not doing something extra, I would want to make sure that that is like there is a reason to pick it and it's not 100 times better or 100 times worse than the other option.
Yeah.
See, honestly, like I find that like, okay, well, I have these three flavors and all mechanically are the same. Like I fucking love them.
Yeah.
Because then you get whatever flavor you want. Like when I go to the ice cream shop, it's all ice cream.
Yeah.
But like my enjoyment is going to be based on flavor. And like, so if I can pick my own flavor that I actually want without having to pay for it in some way.
Yeah.
Or like, if I want to be a weirdo, let's be real. I always want to be a weirdo. Like to not be mechanically punished for it and to be just as effective with my weirdo shit as someone who picks the more like standard option. I find that great.
I love that. This really makes me crave a mechanic in a TTRPG that is really just pick your own weapon, where it's like, pick your own weird mechanic, pick your own material it's made of, like describe how it looks, give it a legend or something, like a myth. I love a fun pick list or like a big, rich table. I love a good table. And I feel like maybe more weapons should be kind of modular like that. I mean, I love designing magic weapons so much because I feel like I get to do that. Like, put all the weird flavor I want into it.
It's interesting to describe it as being punished, though. Because if I can pick that, why wouldn't I pick a D10 for damage if I don't have to pick something less, right? If I want a, so in the just context of D&D, because it's the easiest thing, their distinction is if you're wielding it one-handed, it's a D8, or two-handed, it's a D10 for a longsword.
Yeah.
Like that, I could interpret as like, well, I'm being punished because I want to use a shield, or I'm balancing it because I'm getting this other benefit as well, and it's not fair to somebody else at the table who's doing something similar. It's an interesting way to describe that. And
I'm being punished like specifically for like wanting a dagger.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Like it's like, okay, well, this makes the most sense like narratively for my character. I'm into much more storybook-based games.
Yeah.
So like, okay, I picked the dagger.
I love picking the flavorful option.
Yeah. And then not being punished for that, for the thing that you would think like is appropriate for the character, but because of like some quirk of the mechanics. But I was more talking about your example of like, oh, I have these three weapons and they all end up doing the same amount of damage and they have different flavor text. And I'm right. Like, I love the flavor text. I love that kind of option.
I do too. But I would say there is just one, there's a template, kind of like what you're describing, right? Yeah. Here is a D10 weapon. Say what it does. Is it sharp or blunt? Is it long or short? Can it trip or not? Like you would have to, like, it starts to get so much more complicated for like, okay, well, let's buy points in it. Like, Wild Talents has a whole thing for building out weapons.
Wild Talents, like, assigning points and how good can you
make something. Yeah, we could say, like, oh, well, trip is worth 2 points and then reach is worth -3.
But if I make it rusty, I get a point back.
Right, yeah. Right. That would be fun, but that's a whole mini game, and that's just to, like, get started and play the game. And I would want to see, like, I mean, the other thing I'm going to give Wild Talents its credit is, like, there is also the easy mode of, like, here's a sword.
Yeah.
You
there's
know.
The cafeteria.
Yeah. It does this. Now, if you want a weird sword, you go to work.
Go play the minigame.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, yes, Wild Talents has its cafeteria of miracles and all of that stuff where it's like easier. But honestly, it took me 3 months of playing the game to understand what any of that stuff meant when I read it.
Yeah. And to be clear, I am not recommending people play Wild Talents. That's after a year of playing this game.
I'm really enjoying it, but also like there are some parts where I feel like we've rubbed up against some pretty...
It falls in this difficult. This scale of like they're trying to be real simulationist about some stuff and real hand wavy about a bunch of other stuff. And you got to pick.
Yeah.
Or find an actual middle ground, not do both. In my opinion, I think that falls apart.
Yeah.
There's no like balancing those things. Either get real crunchy and figure out how to do it all the time, or don't be that game.
Here's an interesting thing about Mike said where weapons become unique because they let you perform certain actions that would usually be more restricted. That's something I really like in Baldur's Gate 3, actually, where maybe a weapon allows you access to a spell, but you're not normally a spellcaster. So suddenly you have an ice cantrip because you're wielding, you know, like the Rapier of Cold. And that feels exciting because you don't have to pick a whole spellcaster class just to have access to something fun.
Yeah.
I feel like if I were to design a weapon based on that desire, I wouldn't necessarily even just go with like the social mechanic where, oh, you know, it. Like carrying this rapier makes you better at a ball because it's a, you know, a designed weapon.
It's fancy.
A fancy weapon.
It's a Gucci sword.
Right. But if you don't want it to make combat more complicated necessarily, but still have it have a mechanical benefit, allowing access to other actions in the game might be an interesting thing. Like you can use this rapier as a lockpicking kit.
Mm-hmm.
I would super, super love that. I would definitely pick it.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things, or a couple things, like, so in, we'll just use Baldur's Gate, they did a great job with object design, with magic items, I think. One of them is a trident where when you throw it, it comes back to your hand.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. In the video game, I love it. But if I was at the table, I would need to know, does it travel back to my hand or does it reappear in my hand? Because the difference can matter, right? It means something could get in the way or whatever. Is it Thor's hammer or does it just reappear? Another example, there are two or three long swords, just straight up long swords that do D8 or D10 that use dexterity instead of strength. And that's not often available because that means your dexterity, your triple dipped dexterity, rogue, monk, whatever, can now use a long sword and get this big boost in damage that they wouldn't normally get without having to go down a fighter road. Right. So it's like letting them quadruple dip into their power pool versus having to make some difficult decisions. Yeah. And
it's a great point. When you make weapons more complicated, balance becomes a big thing to consider. And at that point, I think that the GM work does increase of like, if I want to incorporate a more funky weapon system into my game, I have to consider how my encounters become balanced and yada, yada, yada. So my advice for a GM who wants to make weapons more interesting, but not have a worse time, is something that doesn't necessarily mechanically benefit, but is more of a flavor thing. Like, you just get a sword that makes your cloak ripple, or, you know, something fun like that, or allow a player to pick something interesting about how the weapon looks.
Yeah. Or, I mean, to go back to what you were saying before, like, it has an out of combat benefit.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Like, I'm real excited about that.
Okay, mechanically in combat, it's just the same as all the other weapons of its class, but this weapon makes you irresistible to people who like sharp
things. Yeah, you know, just
like whatever.
Especially if it's weird.
Yeah.
Like if me carrying a whip makes me walk quieter or something, like I'm just, that would be so fun to play around with.
You know,
carrying this whip makes you swagger.
Yeah.
And gives you a point in Arcana.
Yeah.
right. So one of the things I think about here is, well, I was Pooja's GM with the whip sword and the punch daggers and all that.
Yeah.
And the thing that made it easy for me to go like, sure, it's a whip sword or it's a punch dagger, whatever, is because like it still does 2 damage, right? Like it was just a flavor text thing. Like, ah, cool. What's it shaped like? That's awesome. It's not that I don't care. That was what I almost said. It's that it doesn't change anything mechanically, which means it hasn't interrupted anything.
Yeah.
And I was able to do, I mean, if I can, I was able to do something similar in my game, Demigods, where all epic weapons do 4 damage. What is it? How? Why? What? That's go nuts.
That was something I really liked about
Is it a flamethrower? Is it a sledgehammer? Is it clown shoe? Like, it doesn't matter what shape it is. It does 4 damage and move on.
You made the ultimate pick list because it's an infinite pick list of how cool your weapon is without having the story leader have to have a complicated time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that was a desperate GM, like figuring out how to give players every weird mythical item in the world. And not have to write every mythical item in the world, which was a choice that I had to make. So that's kind of the framework I think about that in.
I feel like we nailed that topic.
Sure. Well, Gemma says, once the Archblade of Zagmoth is picked up, every cultist of Zagmoth knows which direction it's in and will start seeking out the wielder to return it to Zagmoth's tomb.
Love that.
Fucking great.
Yeah.
And especially as the player who will pick up and lick the cursed object. Yeah, please.
A weird
please
curse is so much fun.
Like, just drag me away. Like,
yeah. Awesome.
Greetings, High Empress Kimmy and the Council of Drama.
Oh, I like that.
It is I, Steffi from Scotland. I write to you today to share an experiment in the art of storytelling and role-playing games. The game was Masks, and I was in my favorite seat as GM. It was session 0 with a group of trusted friends. In the course of working out the group's backstory, the players float around the idea that the PC's classmate, Tina, is the BBEG.
By the way, if you didn't know, Steffi is Steffi from Scotland. And if you wanted to do a Scottish accent, I know she loves it when we do that.
It's a trip. It's a trip. At least I know to call it Gaelic. But I confirm that they are serious. They are. I ask if they're PCs now. They decide that they don't. That's cool. I love a bit of dramatic irony. And this is where Steffi and I part ways entirely. The campaign fell apart just before winter holidays because of scheduling, but we were close to end. None of the PCs had investigated Tina. None of the PCs interacted with Tina if they could avoid it. I gave them ample chance to interact with Tina. I layered clues out for the player characters. Huh. Tina threw a party where the PCs did not engage with her, her parents, or snoop around her home, despite the PCs having evidence that Tina's mother and grandfather were villains.
Damn.
I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Do not get me wrong. I am not mad or upset about any of this. Tina was going to have a grand reveal within a session if scheduling did not crush the game under its cruel heel.
Mm.
Scheduling, our, truly the end game.
That's the BBEG.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. However, I was not expecting her plans to go as smoothly as they did. I feel like if the players hadn't known of Tina's role as the BBEG, they would have engaged more with the main plot.
What is this? Main plot? I'm not familiar with this term. Am I saying that right? It's plot.
I'm not sure. The world may never know. But that they would have crashed through some of her plans blindly at their very worst.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, by avoiding metagaming, they loitered on the outskirts of the main plot line.
Yeah, plot line. Yeah, I plot think. Line. Is it a phrase I've heard but don't understand?
Occasionally tipping a toe in, only to back out at the sight of Tina or evidence pointing at her. I talked with some of my players and they confirmed this read. They were overcompensating because of player knowledge. Maybe this could work if we spoke more about how hard the PCs should push in versus avoiding metagaming.
Yeah.
Overall, my players and I prefer a straightforward mystery, but I wouldn't be opposed to trying this again someday in the future. Do the hosts have any thoughts?
So many.
Similar experiences? Steady. P.S. Fear. Tina.
Fuck.
She was never stopped. She is still out there recruiting BBEGs from other collapsed camps.
Well, then I have to make a note for Pinnacle.
Tina. Red Tina.
I have thoughts. Steffi even had the breakdown with the players of like, what's happening? Right? Everything we normally say is like, well,
talk to the players.
Did you ask your players about what? Like, but I could totally see how this would happen, especially if they're not used to the context in which you have open table secrets.
Yeah.
Like, I love having an open table secret because we can poke at it. Like, if everybody knows that it's my fault, my dad's car went in the river, but I don't know that everyone knows it.
Yeah.
Or my character doesn't know. Suddenly they can hint at stuff. They can bring up stuff that's awkward. And it's like a little meta, but we're telling a story together. That is inherently meta. And they're like, to then not engage with the thing that they asked to set up, right? Is a little, look, I get it. The players got scared, right? Or not spooked is the word I wanted. Yeah. Like, we did it. Now what do we do? Which is totally relatable. But the point of having an open table secret is for everyone to poke at it. Right? Like, that's what makes it fun. Like, when you're watching a TV show and you get a shot of the villain monologuing to their minion that the heroes don't know about, that's fun because you know something the heroes don't know. And we, as players and the GM, like, sometimes we just have to be the audience and the players, and to switch hats is hard to get used to. But I encourage people to welcome that rather than have the plot be this constantly unrolling scroll that the GM is handing out foot by foot. And yeah.
Plot by the foot.
Yes, plot by the foot.
That's good. Yeah. When I first started GMing on stream or even pro GMing, I think I struggled a lot more with these open table secrets. I kind of assumed based on my player experience that a secret was something you were supposed to find out and like investigate. And I loved it. You know, I really enjoyed it. But over the course of my time doing more stream games, I've actually found that some players who might not be like pro improv players really enjoy the opportunity to be able to hint towards something they know I'm excited about. Like if they know above table that there might be a hidden identity thing going on, then they can make jokes about the werewolf without actually saying, oh, we know there's a werewolf. Like, and they can really enjoy that. But it does take some navigation and discussion. And I think players who are trying to be really thoughtful about metagaming might struggle with when they would want the reveal to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a really interesting point, because it is fun, and I get not wanting to, like, because there is that impetus. As anyone who watched that first reveal of Pinnacles knows, like, can struggle as a person with not just, like, if I figure something out, just blurting it out. But never living that down. So I can feel, like, I understand that, like, spooked sensation. But also, like, yeah, you wanted this and you literally asked for it and then avoided it at all costs is very, like, I have a shirt that says, like, Happy Jack's Red Herring Investigation Team.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. And there are a lot of like memes out there about the note taker of the campaign putting something together super early and then the GM going like, oh no, my secret big plot line has been revealed too early. And that can be tough, you know, when you were slow rolling something. I think about timing a lot. I mean, even at a table of players who are all really experienced storytellers and they played a lot of TTRPGs, even then it can be a struggle to figure out exactly when you want to nail that perfect beat on something.
Yeah.
And sometimes it feels good to have it happen just naturally out of the blue. It can take your story in a direction you weren't expecting, and that can be really enjoyable. So I kind of waffle on the what kind of BBEG to share or not, or like hidden enemy. I really enjoy a loose thematic reveal.
Mm-hmm.
Like in a campaign, I might go, this is themed around capitalism or like hunger or...
All the enemies are capitalism.
Yeah. Mm. Or like plague or something.
Pick apart every enemy, it comes down to capitalism.
Yeah. So the players can then pick characters that care about that theme and that villain. Like they know the BBG is capitalism and they all make characters that have this relationship with oppression in some mm-hmm. way. And then we lean into that in the story together. And when the horrible noble crosses their path, they're kind of amped for it and they're ready for it. And they have a reason to care about this guy. So that's usually where I fall on my tables.
I think what can also be interesting with an open table secret is that as your players like hint and poke at it, and then you get to it, and sometimes it can feel anticlimactic on the player side, where it's like, I know this, but my character is just finding it out. But what I've done before a couple of times, or had GMs too, which I thought was really, really fun as a player, is that, yes, okay, you knew this, but here is an aspect of it. Here's a twist on, here's an additional thing that gives you just that little cherry on top. Like, it's a little, like, it's like a, here's your gold star for getting here.
Yeah.
And I really like that. I think it can be, also can make something feel a lot more tied into decisions that the players have made along the way.
Yeah.
Before the show started, Jason and I were talking about romance novels, and people will sometimes ask, like, what is it about a romance novel that really feels like, you know what the end's going to be? They're going to have a happy ever after. And it's like, well, it's how they get there. That's like all of the things they go through, like all of that relationship, all of that, like for me, for that angst, and how it flavors that, what that happy ever after looks like for these characters based on how I've gotten to know them throughout the story. So you get your BBEG, but they have been interned, influenced by the things the characters have gone along
with. I love that.
Yeah.
I will also say on another level, TTRPGs as performance, like if on larger actual plays or a, you know, sponsored stream, because I've been involved in doing some tech direction for things like that, I think an open table secret that everyone at the table knows but the audience doesn't know is fantastic. Like setting up, I'm going to want you to fight the big, scary, poisonous dragon at the end.
Yeah.
And like prepare your build based on not having immunity to poison.
Right.
That would be great. And then the audience gets excited because everyone's like, oh my God, they were all susceptible to poison and there's the dragon. Like, I think that is really, really helpful to consider. And those kind of discussions for like actors, which I'm not one, but I am dating one. I've heard that they are really helpful to be able to prepare the reaction you're going to show to an audience. And TTRPGs' performance are a new medium, an interesting medium. So the way that like a session zero or safety tools might layer with people witnessing you can be really intriguing.
Yeah, I had a setup recently for, it was kind of a trial run, not streamed, but something that might turn into a streamed game. It was basically, it was kind of like a long form audition, right? And we did a thing and they laid out for us a bunch of things about the premise of like, hey, make sure like there's room for this and there's this, and this is true about the world and this and this and this, right? So it was like, don't paint yourself into a corner right out of the gate. Like we have our lines and veils, we did all that. But they also did the reverse of like, this is in the game and we're not going to pull it. So if that's a line for you, this isn't the thing.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I think that's a really good thing to do too. If you have a thought for your game of like, hey, poison dragon, this is the thing. If poison's a thing for you, like, this isn't your set, right? Like, come, we'll do the next one, right? It's not personal. We love you. But like, this is a thing I'm doing and I don't want to change it, right? Because that's the fun thing. If you can put that up front without saying like it's a poison dragon, but just to say like, hey, in this game, there's going to be poison, there's going to be guns, and there's going to be whatever,
yeah,
right? For somebody to go like, ooh, does it have to be guns? Yeah, I'm sorry. It's like a big thing and like it's a theme of what we're doing. I told the Pinnacles cast, like, hey, there's going to be some weird shit happening.
Yeah.
And like, I need a little license to get weird. And had, there's a little more detail than that. But they bought in and like gave me some extra permission. And I also had their lines of veils. But having that extra level of buy-in, I found super handy just recently in that experience that I had of not just lines of veils, but the preemptory sort of like, hey, this is going to be in the story, which didn't reveal anything about what was happening. I mean, I sort of put it together because that's also fun. I don't know how it's going to come to, you know, I don't know how that's going to be the threat. It's sort of like if you're playing a game where people are jumping between dimensions and you notice when they go to another dimension and kill their doppelganger, they get their power. You might make the logical leap that it's based on the movie The One with Jet Li and then blurt it out to the whole table. But in that situation, you might consider not saying it out loud to the table.
Wow. Conversely,
if you have based your BBEG on the plot of The One and a player asks you after the big reveal of a bad guy killing their doppelganger, oh, does The One exist in this universe? You can say no.
But that would go against the world I had set up because it did exist before the awakening.
Yeah.
It was awesome. It was honestly awesome. It wasn't going to be a big secret for long anyway. It was very funny. Anyway.
Yeah.
I got better. The next time Jason based a episode plot on something and I called it, I only called it internally to myself.
I saw it happen. I remember the moment. I'm like, who'd you got it?
That's such a good feeling.
Yeah. And then, you know, like 20 minutes later, it's like, it unfolded. Everyone was like, whoa, you know, it was great.
It did lead to a nice team building, like a table building moment, if you will, where we all watched The One together.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, that's,
I trapped everyone in my house and made them watch The One, which I stand by as a very fun movie.
Yes,
it's not a good movie, but it's fun.
Yeah. All
right. Shall we do the next one?
Yeah, go for it.
Cool. Hello to Kimmy and crew. This is a way late con report, and I'm only mentioning it because I finally returned to convention gaming after an over 20-year absence and was finally able to take my 13-year-old with me. I'll keep it as short as I can. We only went for one day, so that keeps it simple. Okay, so we went to MEPACON in Eastern PA this past fall. Yeah, this is late. My wife doesn't believe my 13-year-old should be running around by himself at a con, so I was required to play in whatever game he played in. Thus, I gave him some guidance, but overall, I let him pick what we wanted to do for the day. So, of course, the first thing he picks was a board game. He wanted to try Risk Star Wars.
Oh, boy.
We ended up having a lot of fun with this.
I'm sure.
My son played the Empire while I played the Rebellion. The Hutt player won because all my son did was focus completely on wiping me out while I clung on desperately trying to survive.
Oh, the peak board game experience.
Yep. We followed that up with Adventurers League D&D. We played Dragonlance. It was okay. It was my son's least favorite event, but he still had some fun playing the least obnoxious Kender ever. Finally, my son had picked Battletech for our final game. Initially, I was scared because it was a scenario where four players went against what the GM had to offer, and the other two players with us seemed like some old-time grognards. How would they react to a teen who had never played and his dad who hadn't played since the 90s? It started out promising when one of the other guys said to my son, "If you want advice, just ask, but otherwise it's your mech. Pilot as you want to." That was reassuring because the other players didn't try to tell us how to run our giant mechs. The game was really fun. It was a mission with certain objectives and not just a blow up the enemy type of scenario. At one point, my son blew up an enemy mech and the other players all gave him a high five and let out cheers.
That's awesome.
So that's how that con went. With my son's schedule and mine, will we ever be able to make it to another con? Who knows? But for one day, it was a father and son gaming together and it was a great day. As always, stay gaming, stay tipsy, and stay diverse. Mugs held high, Eric from New Jersey.
Cheers, Eric. Thank you for that.
Cheers.
That's so sweet. I love when you, like, go into a table at a con and you're like,
yep,
is this gonna, and then it turns out to be amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's such a good feeling.
I actually think one of my favorite games that I've ever run was a game of Morkborg for a full table of, I think, 40 or 50 or 60 something, like, older. Oh,
I thought you were going to say 40 people.
No, not 40 people.
Me too.
I have done stuff like that before.
Like,
collegiate gaming groups, but just, like, older white guys. And they loved it. Like, I have not had a table be so excited about what I was doing and leaning in with me. We went around and they were all, like, kind of awkward about sharing their pronouns. And only one player had played Morkborg before, and he was like, is this the starter adventure? And I was like, no, this, trust me, this is all me.
Was it the cats?
It was the cats one. I mean, Jason has played my cat hack.
If you have the opportunity to play this game at a con with Alex, run, don't walk.
It was a great time.
Yes.
It's a weird twist on it. But it was really amazing. And I feel like it's a very special experience because GMing for strangers can be really negative, especially if they're not as familiar with safety tools. But like being the introduction for players who are not familiar with sharing pronouns or talking about what makes them uncomfortable can be really empowering. It can be something very, very special to have that opportunity. So I love that this was like a coming together of different generations, because that's how people learn. Like, even older nerds can learn a lot from younger nerds and what they want to explore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love seeing that happen too. And I don't want to speak out of turn, but like, as a middle-aged cisgender white man, not straight, but I'm straight passing for the most part, I guess. Like, I have a lot of privilege at tables, but I have walked up to tables, seen all my people and gone like, oh, sorry, I think I'm at the wrong table. Like, I have left, I've walked away. But I've also sat down and been delighted, right? Been very surprised and had a good time. I was like, okay, I shouldn't be so judgmental. But I'm so excited that like these people who seemed like grognards were like, yeah, get in there, kid. Let's go. You know, like, ask if you want, but like, otherwise go nuts. That is just, it's very heartening to hear that. And I hope that the generations going forward, for the most part, are going to be that welcoming and that inclusive.
Mm-hmm. Also say, like, it sounds like a fun con in terms of like breadth of games.
Yeah.
Like, for you to be able to go and like play a board game and play an Adventurers League and play the BattleTech game, like, that's a really great time. Like,
yeah,
to dip your toe into so many different styles, especially with your son who's just starting out and like his long ahead of him nerd journey.
Yeah. Mm. But God, this must have been a great day for a 13-year-old, like. It sounds like so much
fun. I mean, 13-year-old me would have just been like,
yeah,
you know.
But also, like, it's so good to, like, be able to, for Eric to, like, experience that with him.
Yeah.
Even though it does sound like there was a little bit of stuff that you didn't get to do because you were doing the dad thing all day. But it is, like, it does sound like you also had a really good time.
And I don't honestly, like, not to pick sides here, but I am kind of on board with, like, sticking with the 13-year-old.
Oh,
like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
As somebody at a con, like when there is an unmonitored 13, 14-year-old, I am a little leery of like, okay, how's this going to get? Like, it can get real weird or uncomfortable, especially if their guardian isn't around and they get into saying something inappropriate or whatever. And because they don't know better, or they're just fucking up.
Yeah.
And that's the kids fuck up sometimes. And it's just nice to have their guardian around until they're, you know, like a 15, 16-year-old, you know what? I'm going to take them on their own merits and we'll...
Yeah.
But like an early teen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It just feels like one of those situations where you're like, who should have a responsible party with you?
Yes.
Or it's just for everyone's well-being.
Yeah. This kind of made me laugh because I just got the image of taking my dad to a con and I would not abandon him either.
Like, well, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah. Struggle is... in the chat, worth keeping in mind that elder millennials are now in their mid-40s, but even a lot of Gen Xers are good with this stuff. My generation is kind of 50-50.
Yeah.
And it's true. Like, I mean, it is a good point that, like, ageism isn't a good look, but at the same time, sometimes experience speaks for itself. We've all had our own experiences at tables with different people, and it's really good to keep an open mind about things that, like, these aren't necessarily always the people that you encountered in your past.
Yeah. Oh, I remembered what I was going to say earlier. everything you described about what made this trip so good. There were board games. There was TTRPGs. There was all these activities. That's Strategicon.
Check it out.
Three times a year, GameX coming in May, May 24th to 27th. Like, we get to do this all the time. If you're anywhere in Southern California or you're going to be in the area, like, come check it out. It's not very expensive for a con if you don't have to get a hotel. You know, day passes and stuff. Like, it's honestly blessed. There's the huge board game section. There's a wargaming section. There's card games. There's Adventurers League. There's weird indie TTRPGs happening. It. Like, it's, you
and
know.
If you don't know what you want to do and you want to find it out on the day, and there's, like, games on demand downstairs, which is always fun because, like, if you have problems with commitment, I'm not saying any of us have problems with commitment, but sometimes I do look in the mirror.
And it just reminds me, too, like, as someone who's worked at so many conventions, I haven't done a lot of cons where I just go and sit down and play games all day. But for some people, like, that is their special experience. I think of Gen Con, like, there are people who come so far to Indianapolis just to play games for 4 days straight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because it's hard to get a group at home, or it's hard to get a group in person now. It's like
the only time they play for some people. And it's a really special experience.
Or I feel like for a lot of our listeners, like, if they have a group and they've got, but that group is kind of like married to a system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And isn't so open to branching out. Or if before you like invest in some of these systems, like you want to try them out.
Oh,
you want to see how it plays.
Sure.
Yeah.
Like, cons are a great time to do that, to see it in a setting, especially with like a lot of these games, the GMs, like our professional GMs, are there people who have run these games a lot.
Yeah.
So you get the benefit of that experience to really get like a nice like tasting flight of a bunch of different RPGs.
And dovetail on that even further, a lot of times there are people there playtesting stuff. Mm-hmm. I got to play a version of For the Queen before it came out, before anybody knew what it was. It was just something Tomes had at Games on Demand because he knows Alex Roberts. Like,
cool.
And he was like, hey guys, go check out this cool game. I was like, what is this? This is magic. Alex is a witch. What, like, how does she do this? But it blew everyone's mind. We're like, this is going to be a big deal. And then what do you know? The next year, it was flying off shelves. And
I'm really excited for the second edition.
I am too.
I've gotten to take a look at it, and it is beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Darrington just picked that up, didn't they?
Darrington designed and released the second edition.
That's right.
So I got some.
That wasn't even an intentional plug.
No.
I'm just, like, so excited about
again,
that game.
Not to plug, but, like, I am also a big fan of For the Queen. And I think there are so many games to get their start at conventions and then just take off, which is so cool.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, even better if you bring a friend. And that way, if you just have a problem being in a group of people that are all people you don't know.
Yep.
Have a buddy.
You have a buddy.
Well,
safety is for adults.
Thank you for joining us for season 33, episode 18. My name's Jason.
I've been Alex.
I'm Pooja.
Please support our amazing Indie Designer of the Month. I think that's last month.
Yeah, that is.
Our amazing Indie Designer of the Month is Craig Campbell of Nerdburger Games. We had a link for that a minute ago in the chat, but it will also be in the show notes. Thank you to our chat mods, James V, and other mods that we have during other games. We can't do this live without you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you to our Patreons who let us do this ad-free and independent. We could do and say whatever we want because no one's paying us. So if you have a few bucks to throw that way, Kimmy has put blood, sweat, and tears. Literally, yes. I've seen all three in this studio, and it is such an amazing space to have available to us. So if you, not everybody can, we get it. That's fine. If you can, it's appreciated. And theoretically, this is up to date that we are going to leave you with the song Star of the County Down by Sportive Tricks. You can go to sportivetricks.com and check out more of their stuff. Friend of the show, Kurt Hanna and all that group. So,
oh, fantastic.
Yeah. All right, everybody. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye.
Remember cottage down in the county down one morning last July. Down a boring green came a sweet calling, and she smiled as she passed me by. But she looked so neat from her two bare feet to the sheen of her nut brown hair. Such a coaxing elf, I shook myself to make sure I was standing there. From Pantry Bay up to Derry Kay, from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the brown Colleen that I met in the county down. As she on was fed, I shook my head and I gazed with a feeling queer. And I said, says I, to a passerby who's a maid with the nut brown hair. Oh, he smiled at me and with pride says he, that's the gem of all Ireland's crown. She's young Rosie McCann from the banks of the band, she's a star of the county down. From Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the brown Colleen that I met in the county down. Well, I've travelled a bit, but was never hit since my roving career began. But fair and square I surrendered there to the charms of Rose McCann. Had a heart to let to no tenant, yet did I meet with a shawl or gown. But in she went, and alas, no rent from the star of the county down. From Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the brown Colleen that I met in the county down. Crossroads fair, I'll be surely there, and I'll dress in my Sunday clothes, with my shoes shone bright and my hat cocked right, for a smile from my nut brown rose. No pipe I'll smoke, no horse I'll yoke, though my plough with the rust turns brown. Till a smiling bride by my own fireside sits the star of the county down. From Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, and we're going to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like a brown Colleen that I met in the county down. From Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, and we're going to Dublin town.
This show is a product of the Happy Jacks RPG Network. The Mary Sues performed our intro music, and our ending song was played with the express permission of the artist. Visit happyjacks.org for more information and to find all our streams and podcasts.